Welcome. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Manhattan, Kansas. This month, we celebrate the feast day of St. Valentine on February 14th, the actual feast day. St. Valentine is the Catholic patron saint of love, young people, and happy unions, as well as beekeepers. His arrest and martyrdom in about the year 269 resulted from his joining Christian couples together in marriage, a practice that was by Roman law forbidden at the time. In the spirit of St. Valentine, we welcome this morning those of you who are in love, who are young, and who are blessed with the embrace of a happy union to our fellowship. We also welcome those of you who may not be in love, who may not be young, at least in years, or may not be in a union to share in this fellowship. All are welcome here, even beekeepers. Nick will light our chalice for us to begin this morning's service. We light this chalice to cast light on what we do here this morning, and in honor of all of those who have come before and all who may come after, who have, do now, and will continue to shed light wherever they tread. Thank you, Nick. The announcements this morning are on the printed in the order of service, with one exception. Stacy has pointed out to me that the Social Action Committee will not be meeting on February 8th. They will be meeting on March 7th is the next meeting. Another announcement, near the end of this morning's service, Corey and the children will come in and give us the score on their Super Bowl Sunday can collection. So look forward to that announcement. And I invite those of you who are interested in finding out more about our fellowship or who may want to explore the possibility of membership to meet with Shirley Holbrook. Is Shirley here? I think they're out of town. But to meet with the greeters outside during the coffee hour to talk more about the fellowship and becoming a member if you're interested. Our opening hymn this morning is number 410, Surprised by Joy. This is a bit of a complicated piece of music, as is the last hymn this morning. So Marilyn's going to play the song all the way through before we start singing it, just to give everybody kind of an idea of what to expect. So hymn number 410, please stand as you are able to join us in singing Surprised by Joy. This is the pastoral care, joys and concerns time of the service. If any of you feel so moved as to share any personal joys or concerns, Doug will be walking around with a microphone, and please feel free to share.
Sabrina Boker, I have a good joy. My brother finally got a job. Hooray. So, and the bad concern is I got a cold, but I'm trying not to give it to anybody.
Any other joys, concerns to share?
Hello. I have kind of a concern. My husband, who is our sole income, has to have his complete ACL and his meniscus repaired / replaced. So he's probably going to be out for a few months. So, yeah.
Thank you for sharing, and for those of you who have joys or concerns that you did not wish to express, we all share with you. Corey will now be leading the children in a story.
Come on up. See?
We're actually going to be playing a game today, so I need a little bit of setup time. Nick, we're going to be putting chairs where you are, so... No, you guys should actually sit down here. Yeah.
Folks, watch the cord,
Okay, so today the adults are going to be talking about the economics of love. Okay, so when I heard that title, it reminded me of a game show that used to be on TV back in the day called The Dating Game. And so we're going to do a version of that today, okay? No dating, though. Ours is called The Friendship Game, okay? All right, so I first need a volunteer to be our friend. Okay, Carrie, you're up. Come on over here. Okay, I'm going to blindfold you. You're looking good. All right. Now, without talking, if you want to volunteer to be one of our other three friends, just raise your hand, but don't say anything. Okay. Go sit in one of the chairs. Okay. Let's see. Go sit in one of the chairs. Okay. Sit in one of the chairs. Okay. Here we go. Now, here's the object of the game. Carrie, you don't know who your three friend choices are. You can't see them, but I'm going to explain them to you, and you're going to have to pick a friend based on their description only, okay? This friend is in the fifth grade. She has a sibling. She likes dressing up, putting on fancy clothes. She is really great with younger kids, and she's super nice. Friend number two is in kindergarten. She also has a sibling. She likes playing with baby dolls, and she's really good at artwork. She loves glitter, and she's really nice. Friend number three is in the third grade. She also has a sibling. She wears really cool outfits. She Likes to play outside and inside. She's got wicked cool jewelry that sometimes she brings to the fellowship. And she is super nice to her friends. So you need to make a choice based on those descriptions. Do you choose friend number one, friend number two, or friend number three?
Friend number... Look, I know who they all are. So
oh, you do? Oh, okay. Do you have any, actually, before we you make a choice, do you have any specific questions, things that you look for in a friend that you would like friend number one, friend number two, or friend number three to answer?
Friend number one, to make sure I'm right, is your hair short?
Do you have short hair, friend number one?
Yes.
Okay, yes. Okay, any other questions? So do you only like friends that have short hair?
I like friends just because of who they are.
Okay, so how do you pick a friend?
Well, I have to say friend number three, who I really think is Indigo.
Oh, I don't know. It's hard to tell. So what do you look for in a friend?
Well, I look for that they're really nice, like all three of them. And their friend, if they like me for who I am, and I like them for who they are.
So do you want to see if they like you for who you are? Okay. So friend number one, do you like Carrie for who she is?
Yes.
Friend number two, do you like Carrie for who she is?
Yeah.
Friend number three, do you like Carrie for who she is?
Yes.
Okay. This is going to make your choice a little tough. Any other qualifications for a friend?
Would I choose friend number three?
Okay. Friend number three, you guys win a vacation to Count Cans. Yes, you can take it up. So what was so interesting about this game show and about the game that we play today is we often make judgments about people based on what they look like, right? And sometimes it's good to think about maybe what a friend is just by the qualities that they have, even if you couldn't see them. So I have a feeling today the adults are going to be talking about sort of emotional love versus sort of intellectual love. And today Carrie made sort of an intellectual choice about friends because her heart couldn't take a look at Indigo's beauty and see her gorgeous skirt. Okay. All right, guys. Go.
Some of you with teenage sons may have already learned when one thinks one knows where things are and one goes to get it, it is often not there. Therefore, this morning's song for to accompany the offertory was to be a song by Bob Marley, which Vincent was going to bring on CD, but when he went to the pantry, it was not there. So we have mystery music this morning, and this is Doug's choice. But during this part of the service, please share as you desire to support the continuing good works of this fellowship. Thank you. Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love which alters when an alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove. Oh no, it is never fixed mark that looks on tempests and is never shaken. It is the star to every wandering bark, whose worth's unknown, although his height be taken. Love's not time's fool, though rosy lips and cheeks within his bending sickle's compass come. Love alters not with his brief hours and weeks, but bears it out even to the edge of doom. If this be air, and upon me proved, I never writ, nor no man ever loved. Thus spoke the poet of love. And as poetry is the mirror of the soul, economics is often described as the window into the human mind. Well, it is sometimes described as the window into the human mind. Okay, I've never actually heard it described as the window into the human mind. However, this has not limited the reach of economists into areas shared with psychologists, philosophers, neuroscientists, and even poets. This morning, we are very fortunate to have Vincent Amanor-Boudot, an economist at Kansas State University, provide his perspective on this thing called love. Vincent?
Thank you very much for inviting me. I have spoken in many places, but not in a religious setting, however we define it. We did a little bit of research on what the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship was, and as a Catholic, I found that I agreed with you a lot more than I agree with the Catholic Church. I can understand that. The story, though, is that, as my wife said, I should not let my mother know because she probably will start doing novenas and praying very hard for my soul. But it's great to be here. I'm going to talk to you about three things, and it's a flow. I'm going to present to you how love became a research activity for an economist. As David read the sonnet by Mr. Shakespeare, I could feel that that is not the realm of an economist. Number one, we don't speak with such eloquence and beauty because ours is a profession that is typically described as dooms stories. We talk about money, and we talk about unemployment, and we talk about inflation, and we talk about all the things that leave us with higher blood pressure than we normally want to. And yet, when you pause to think about it, as Dave rightly noted, economics transcends all activities of humans, and love falls in that principal activity. The opening song today had a line that touched me. Beyond all other gifts is this, best gift alone to mortals given. And I think St. Paul described that also in his Corinthians letter when he said of these three, love is the greatest. We've written more, played more, danced more about love than we have done almost than anything else. It still captures the imagination of all humanity, young and old. And it's actually nothing more beautiful, as Mr. Joyce wrote, to see an old man fall in love. There are other philosophers and poets who said the worst thing a man can do is to fall in love when he is over 40. But my interest in love as a research subject started from a very simple question. Why are we here and what are we supposed to do? And this is the philosophical question that has worried almost all thinkers for generations and centuries. And probably about 2 decades ago, I was sitting in my basement and it dawned on me. We are here to do nothing but love. And I ran upstairs, called my wife and said, "Eureka!" And by this time she has gotten used to my discoveries. So I didn't get the type of excitement I was looking for from her, which, as you know, for humans with a Y chromosome, We always seek that affirmation from the other humans with a double X chromosome. And I kept my enthusiasm up, pulled her from her kitchen activity and said, this is the most most important discovery your lover has ever made. We are here to love. And she looked at me and said, it took you this long. But I'm a teacher. And a major part of my work involves engaging my students in conversations beyond just what they are supposed to know. It is making them into humans so that they can do things the right way. And I found that one of the most interesting frames to use in my conversations with my students to get them really excited about the subject of economics is to frame it in love. And there is nothing more interesting than watching a young person walk into class and not be very interested in anything. They've already made up their mind that there is nothing you as a professor can tell them today that will excite them. And they walk into class and you have an equation on the board that says L is equal to, and you have a series of variables behind it. And you ask them, what is this? And they said, labor? No. Land? No. Well, L is for love. And they look at you and say, gosh, I knew he was nuts, but I didn't know it was this deep. You take them through a maximization process and tell them about how life is all about doing the right things and using resources in the most efficient way as good stewards of the land and of everything else that has been given us, including love and time. So my grad student walks up to me and her eyes are red and heavy and it looks like life is coming to an end in her mind. And nothing else is worth doing. And so I prod, what's going on? Well, I'm not sure I can tell you. Well, if you walk into my office with heavy eyes, you definitely want to tell me something. Well, I broke up with him. With who? My boyfriend. Well, you never told me you had a boyfriend. Well, you never asked. So we get into this conversation, and finally she says, if it's supposed to make us feel so good, why does it hurt so much? If it's supposed to make it feel so good, why does it hurt so much? And I said, let us look at this as an economic problem. Her immediate reaction was, Dr. Vincent, this is my life. And I said, I know, but your life is economics. That's your profession. That's what you've sworn to do. She said, I never did swear anything. Anyway, so that was the onset of my critical work on what love means when framed within the economic framework. And I'm going to try and work with you how we solved this problem. Robert Hazel wrote a book that is out of print now in which he defined love as promoting the highest well-being. And if you stop to think about it, promoting the highest well-being of the beloved is the sole purpose and focus of the lover, isn't it? As an economist, when I start thinking about it and frame it within the fact that all purposeful human action is driven by the self, then my interest in promoting the highest well-being of my lover also promotes my well-being. and that is the dual outcome of loving. Romantic love, unlike all other loves, thrives only with reciprocity. You fall in love, and it's the only type of love we used falling to describe. And you can swim in it as long as somebody else is keeping the water going. And after you've tried and tried and it's not working, guess what? It becomes so expensive that you either give up or you die of heartache. This is no secret in my household, but I think I can make it public here because this is family and you won't take it anywhere else. But I have had a very soft spot for Sandra Bullock for a long time. I think she's the most funniest, most beautiful, most exciting woman out there, but I don't say it when my wife is around. But she reads it because she can read my mind. If I'm flipping through the TV channels and Sandra's face shows up, I stop. And it could be one of her most silliest movies. And I find it just exciting. But I would not allow myself to fall in love with Sandra Bullock because it is just too expensive. It'll be an exercise in futility. And when in the past few years her husband decided to play games and all that stuff and she was going through all those problems, I said, you see, if only you had been patient, you would never had to go through this pain with me. But that is not to be. And that is the beauty, I think, of thinking about this romantic love from an economic perspective. If we are going to seek and promote the highest well-being of the beloved, then we are going to make investments. And we make investments in time, we make investments in creativity, we make investments in effort. And those investments that we make are the resources that go into being in love. They are very expensive, as you've, most of you have probably, and I have a teenager now who is going through those roller coasters where somebody is the world 1 week and the following week, the whole world has fallen apart. And but when you think about those investments that we have to make, then of course, love becomes an economic problem. If I have to invest time in order to make my beloved happy, that time becomes unavailable to watch football. Okay? And so we trade. And we are finding the perfect combination of how much love to, how much time to invest to get the right output of this love thing that we are talking about. And when you spend too much on one and not on the other, for the Y chromosome people generally here, we tend to spend too much on Sunday afternoons during the fall on football and get into a lot of trouble. And if you remember, Mr. Shakespeare also wrote in his rather very interesting play depicting Cleopatra and her love with Mark Antony. The story was Mark Antony stayed in Egypt while his soldiers were fighting a war, and as a general, he had basically abdicated his role in place of love. And that affected Mark Antony's position as a soldier and as a leader. This morning, on Sunday morning, there was a story about the English King Edward, who abdicated his throne in favor of his lover. And that was seen as something weak. So here we are in a society that cherishes and adores love. And at the same time, when choices are made in favor of love, where norms are not sort of fulfilled, we look down on it as wrong choices. And lovers have to make those decisions. So how do we solve this? Well, for my young student who walked in with the heavy eyes, we went to the erasable board and pulled our pens and started modeling this thing called love. It hurts because my desire is to seek your highest well-being. But I am the one to do it and nobody else. So in your happiness that I am seeking to provide is my happiness. So the happier you become, the happier I become. So imagine this, that I have a love meter on my lover's forehead, and I'm the only one who can read it. Okay? And as I make her happy, I can see that meter go up. And because that meter is going up, I invest more time and effort because I like the result I'm seeing. Now, she walks in and says, "It's not you. It's me, but." And you see that meter go down. And the initial response is to be hard on yourself and say, if I invest more resources, if I invest more time, if I invest more creativity, if I write more sonnets, if I write more poems, I can get that meter to go back up. So you do that, and as you do that, you are not doing anything else. And the more you do it, the more the meter goes the wrong way. And that's why it hurts. Because we have what economists call nested utility function, where your happiness is nested in the happiness of your beloved. And whenever the beloved's happiness goes up and it does not increase your happiness because it doesn't include you, the world becomes very unfriendly. But let us look at it differently, and this is what we worked on. That if indeed the purposeful action is for us to love because it makes us happy, it increases our well-being, then does it matter that that love is not reciprocated? So let's decouple that nested utility function and tell ourselves that what I desire for my beloved is to see him or her as happier and her well-being at the peak at all times, whether it includes me or not. And if he or she should cry or feel sad on any occasion where her well-being is low, my love meter will go down, whether it's with me or not. And I think that is what a lot of the poets and philosophers and religious writers talk about. When Rumi writes about love letters to God, I think what he's talking about is this romantic love that is focused on the self and not on the other. And it sounds a little strange to think about love as focusing on the self and not on the other. Because if I can love by focusing on me and my happiness and my well-being, then by Jove, it becomes easy for me to seek that well-being in the other. And it's not as complex as it sounds, because what basically I think happens is that when I remove the fact that I am the only one to make this person happy, or I am the only one who can improve the well-being, I am in effect limiting the potential of that person's well-being. But that's the hard part. Although it's also the challenge to us as lovers to see that need for the other to maximize their well-being. So we called upon, I think, in this eureka moment that I had, that we love not for the other, but for us. And when we do that, our judgments go down. We become more attentive to the needs of the others, as, and we become more loving, because the self will always do what is in the self's interest. And when it is purposeful, then the beauty is that it leaves no pain.
Thank you, Vincent. We're open for discussion, and if there can be any discussion pro or against, please feel free.
Yes.
I agree with much of what you say, but I wonder how you keep from slipping from the ideal into the destructive self-centeredness that allows a person then to flit from whatever he or she wants without regard to others.
It's what I have looked at and termed the conscious awareness. A lot of the things that, a lot of the challenges I have as a human being is not paying enough attention to what I am doing and what my focus is most of the time. And let me frame it with a story. I come back home late this week, and I'm very excited because some nice things have happened at work. And I get home, and all I want is for my wife to sit and share these excitements with me. Now, she's just got back. Her dad had a stroke, and she's gone to visit, and she's back, and she's getting ready to take our son to Chicago for his school visits and interviews and stuff like that. And I know that. I know she has all these things on her mind. And at the same time, I want her to pay attention to me because I'm that little baby. Okay? And then I become aware of that and say, honey, it's okay. The story can wait because it's not going anywhere. But I needed that moment of remembering. And I think it's the humility. Sometimes I think the challenge for us as humans is when we get on this roll, we have difficulty stepping back and being humble about the fact that I messed up. And so we keep it going. We are going to make the wrong right. And the more we scream and yell and fight, the righter it will become. As an economist, I look at that and say, that is terrible investment. It's like putting resources into a company that is losing and telling yourself that, you know, if only I put more in it, it'll work. So I allow my awareness to humble me and reframe the environment. And that's a challenge. I'm not, you know, trivializing this at all. It's a challenge, but I think if we are going to grow as human beings in the direction that we are challenged to grow, humility is the first step that we have to take and recognize that The self is only here to serve the other. And that awareness, that mindfulness, becomes then the channel for us to deal with this risk that you just talked about. Does that help? Okay, thank you.
Anna Franklin, hi. So I'm a yoga teacher, so when you talk about awareness, I'm drawn to a quote from a great yoga teacher, T.K.V. Desikachar, and he said the ultimate goal of yoga is to always perceive things as they truly are so that we never act in a way that we later regret our actions. Mm-hmm. So that seems to fit.
There's a group of economists who say that. They're the Austrian economists. They say you have to look at what people do instead of what they ought to do. Because most of what we do is to look for what is or what ought to be and try to fit it. And when you look at what they do, it becomes very interesting what we can learn. So they are more, you know, you never think that they will be like yogis, but it looks like economists are that way. Yes,
thank
sir.
You. I'd like to mention that this kind of dovetails with the dissonance that I feel from the Ayn Rand group, the self-interest first. And I think what they're missing is the first word, the enlightened self-interest. They're not putting enough emphasis on the enlightened part. That if you're going to do it for yourself, you need to be humble. You need to step back and say, what's best for me is often doing what's best for those around me.
Right. No, you're right. And, you know, when I talk about this, people often hear that self-interest and don't hear the other part. And the critical thing here is that I think that the self is never independent of the other. Okay? No human is an island. And that recognition that you are connected constantly and infinitely to your past, present, and future is what separates us from some of those philosophers who believe that taking care of me, regardless of anybody else, will give me the result I want. It doesn't happen that way. We've watched people, very poor people by our standards, make some very interesting decisions in favor of the future. Among the Akans in southern Ghana, the fishermen do not fish on Tuesdays. No fisherman in this particular ethnic group will go to sea on Tuesday. And when you ask them why not, they say the sea needs to breathe. Okay? These are people that we will, in our Western mind, say are peasants, illiterate. And they figured out that the sea needs to breathe. And so at least one day a week, all canoes and nets are on shore. And for me, that is not just self-interest. It's recognizing that in order to preserve my own interest, I need to keep this resource going. Okay? And it comes with wisdom and humility. And that's the part that I think sometimes we miss. As a scholar, one of the things that I have learned, the more I know, the more I feel humble about what I don't know. And that humility calls on me to constantly feel that I have to learn more. My mechanic, for example, when we were in Canada, I was dealing with a very difficult turnaround activity in a business that I was working with. And I was just telling my mechanic about these, and he said, have you tried the I promise? And I said, what's that? And he said, well, get everybody to promise what they will do and then hold them accountable. I said, well, who wrote that? I said, I don't know. I'm just telling you to go try it. So on Monday morning, I went in and I implemented this. I sat down with the management team and I said, okay, everybody tell us what you're going to do this week and we'll write it down. And then the following week, you come and you say, okay, you promised this. Tell us how you accomplished it. And within a few weeks, the non-performers had figured out that they didn't like promising and not keeping their promise. And they left on their own. And it's that humility that my mechanic, who in our social structure is supposed to be at the bottom, but incidentally can kill me faster than my doctor. okay. Gave me insights that I haven't come to. And I think it's recognizing our collective gifts and knowing that everybody has a role to play. And if we are going to make this place better for us all, then we have to look for and invite the talent and in everybody else at all stages and bring all that to the game. But it requires that humility to do that. And once you recognize that your independence is actually not independence at all, but dependent on everybody else's independence, your interest, your self-interest becomes very enlightened. Becomes very enlightened. Yes, sir.
I guess you kind of already addressed what I was going to ask. I was going to ask you, do you think that the awareness, the humility, and the is enough to keep from fallen into the love of power and the love of money, you know, and how you would compare that to the romantic aspect of
yeah.
it, and how would a responsible group of people recognize that trait in another group of people, and what do we do about it?
I think that the risk often of us falling into this, you know, love of, is the limitation of the of, because it is love for that should be driving us. Because when we love for, then it becomes an activity for the good of, right? Whereas when it's focused on you in the way that we are talking, where it's all about you and you don't see the dependency that exists, you run the risk then of running into this problem. And most of the time we see that. We see that, but I think it comes from when people lose the awareness. For me, the critical thing is to get my lover to try and center me. I've given her the job of being my number one critic, that when she sees me getting too excited about my frailties, she should remind me that I'm only human and that I should come back to earth. My dad reminded me of how the Romans treated their heroes. When Caesar comes back from war as a victor, he rides the chariot through the streets of Rome. But always on that chariot is a slave kneeling beside him. And the story, my dad's interpretation of that, was Caesar needed to be reminded that but for the grace of God, he will be the one kneeling on the chariot. And the hailing from the crowd would not be for him. And that sits very strongly in my mind in everything that I do. That I'm no better than the guy who didn't get it. It is just by grace. And that is the first step of humility in everything. And I really find that once I start embracing this conscious awareness about humility, it makes a lot of things that I do a lot easier. I fret less. I sleep well. You know, I just have a really good time living. and I think that that's, you know, that's about it. I mean, it makes life really easy. Yes, sir.
Vincent, I'm wondering how you economists distinguish romantic love from the love that one has for parents or
right.
children or siblings or even good friends.
Right.
Is it, well, you have the floor.
Yeah. When I was preparing this conversation, and I'm going to make a confession, I had Michael in my mind as my audience. And I don't know if Michael remembers this, but after he retired from the department, he came in one morning, and I was walking the hall, and he saw me and called me. I said, come. And he took me to one end of the hall and said, look down. In Waters Hall at the university, if you stand on the third floor, in one of the corners and you look down, there was a garden on the ground floor. And he pointed it out to me that, look down, this is one of the most beautiful spots on this campus with the biodiversity of trees and plants and all that. I don't know if you remember that. But I had been on that floor for about 9 years and I'd never seen it. and he pointed that out to me. So I thank him for it. Romantic love is a love of choice. The filial love is one of duty. And people will usually put it that way. And because of that, they rationalize it very differently. I have a responsibility to love my child and a responsibility to love my parents and stuff like that. So it's the duty component, I think, changes the model that we can run here, and it becomes a constraint because you can relax that model and that constraint and say, well, you know, I don't care. But if we look at it from the perspective of choice, then choosing my friends or choosing my lover becomes one that fits this conversation as an economist for me. The complexity of trying to model the duty component is, I think, something that we are going to continue working on to see if we can find some sensible ways of thinking about this.
I just had an aha moment when you talk about the filial, the duty love versus the romantic what word you use, of choice.
Right.
Could be tied into this difference when they're talking about capitalism versus socialism. When something becomes socialism, it's duty. You've got to do it. You have very few freedoms.
Right.
So when they talk about freedom, and they're talking about, I want to do what I fall in love with,
right,
and that's the capitalist, I can dump it if I don't like it.
Right.
So it's an interesting way to frame that topic as well. Where a life, a real life, is a combination of the two. And that's where I believe economics really has the sweet spot, where we have certain duties, but then we have the freedoms to express ourselves.
The metaphor I use is that in our education system, we try very much to provide black and white, good and evil, you know, frames. And everybody forgets that between those thin, very thin bookends is this wide band of gray. Okay? So whether it is love or hate, you have this wide band of gray, you know, that frames it. And being able to hold this multiple views, you know, and be able to handle the complexity. One of the lines that I use when I'm speaking to my farmers in rural Kansas is that complexity is good. Because we like simplifying things. And the more simplified the problem, the greater the probability that the solution is wrong because you've defined it wrongly. You know, it's a very complex life. I mean, my simple little life, just me, when I take everybody else in my family out, it's extremely complex. And sometimes I don't understand me. You know, so it's very important for us to see this continuum and not, you know, position ourselves to be pulled into one camp or the other. Are you Republican? Are you Democrat? Are you Christian or not Christian? I think I was telling David about one of my very good friends in graduate school. For a long time, we studied together, we did a lot of schoolwork together, and never talked about who we were. Until one evening when we were just sitting and we were talking about the things we believed in. And after about an hour of this intense conversation, I looked at him and I said, "What faith do you belong to?" And he said, "I'm a Muslim." And I said, "By Jove, we've just been praying for an hour." So I went to church on Sunday and I was really excited about this discovery. So I was telling, you know, my friends at church, "How wonderful, I prayed with this Muslim for an hour." And they all started moving back. You can't do that. But for me, it was a discovery that without the labels, without the camps, we share the fundamentals, and we can get through a lot of the problems that, you know, confront us as humans if we can get rid of the labels. SCTV is a Canadian show that has a character, and I think the character's name is Pat, and I don't know if you've seen it, but you know, I've never heard anything she said every time I watched it, because I spend the whole time trying to figure out, is this male or female? Okay? And that attempt to box this person so that I can listen to the person through the frame that I've put around him or her becomes our limitation. We don't hear anymore, because if you are black, then these are the subliminal things you are saying. And I never said that. And if you are white, you know, so we need those boxes. But I think as we walk into this beautiful world that has been entrusted to us, it becomes our duty, really, to get rid of the boxes. Science is helping us do that, because science is showing us that we are more alike than we are different. You know, those of you know, my wife is Caucasian, and I said, you know, we don't want to do the DNA test because I don't want to know that we are related. Yes, sir.
Yeah, very interesting. Biologists will have very much the same, they'll be in agreement with you on these, on the resources, the time, the heartache that goes into loving relationships. Is a resource, and it results, though, I think in Fort Knox, biologists are keeping genes, okay? And we refer to genetic fitness or fitness, reproductive fitness in general. Every adaptation we have, whether it be opposable thumbs, the ability to think and make decisions, or the choosing of mates, right, has to do with sending our genes to the next generation. So your comment about the filial relationship as being an obligation, we would say that is inclusive fitness, we biologists. We love our children. We love our brothers and sisters and our parents because we share genes with them directly. Right. We select a mate who will then help us carry our genes. And that right. mate, usually it's the double X one that selects the Y-bearing one. They are in charge.
Even though they think they are in charge.
Yeah, right? And the XYs are fighting over those XXs all the time. And I did have a point here, but one point was the similarity, but the other one, I guess, was the difference that selfless behavior, which biologists might refer to as altruism, helping others with no apparent benefit, truly is seen, again, in many biologists, I don't want to speak for all, as selfish behavior because of the expectation that right. it might happen to you.
Right.
And one of the ultimate ones is, how do you explain that anybody would inherit the ability to jump in a freezing river to save some total stranger? Right. You know, it's referred to as reciprocal altruism, yep. the assumption that it would hopefully happen for you as well.
That's true.
So I don't know if economists are thinking about that.
Yes, actually, in 17... And Michael, if I'm wrong, you might correct me here, but Mr. Smith's first book was The Theory of Moral Sentiments. Before he wrote the book that is most popular, The Wealth of Nations, he had written a book titled The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And the first line of that book said, and I'm not quoting but paraphrasing, that it is normal for people to rejoice in the good that happens to others, even though they get no benefit from it. And I think that is what a lot of people who try to jump, you know, into this selfishness environment, forget. If we watch what people do instead of what we want them to do, because if you are modeling this selflessness, you know, because of self-interest, it becomes very complex, you know. And so we make all these constraining assumptions. The problem is then we start beginning our, we start believing our assumptions, that our assumptions are real, and we talk about them as if they are the reality. So that's the challenge. And for me, as a teacher, one of the things I try to get my students to remember is always be aware of the assumptions we are making in order to explain what we are trying to understand and not take those assumptions as reality. We made them up in order to allow us to think, but that's not our reality.
Marilyn Caldwell, I am a writer of romantic suspense, and your thesis has just opened the door to a multitude of plots. And if you ever write up this thesis, I will definitely get it on the website of Mystery Writers of America and Romance Writers of America.
Actually, we have a paper out, Cupid's Arrow in an Economist's Quiver. And it looked at this in a very, you know, similar to the conversation we've just had. We didn't use any equations, and we took out all the crazy things economists would like to see before they publish it, so we can get you a copy of that. Yeah.
So one quick comment here, and it's that the discussion of the biological point of view and the future opened up a way of saying this. I wasn't sure exactly what to say. I think we get a lot out of these conversations, these discussions, these analysis, this modeling. But it's also important for us to understand, sort of, as you've pointed out, sort of what application they may have, right? So, so you've been talking mostly about modeling a certain kind of behavior, feelings from a self-interest, mm-hmm. but you know, enlightened self-interest, right? And then we've got brought up, well, you know, there's another view of a sort of even more enlightened, not just my immediate self-interest, but you know, for my progeny type right. of thing, right? My genes and, you know, et cetera. And so it's the genes that matter. And, you know, if we can also take another step back and recognize that, well, look, what we're doing for all these models is we're pointing out for a certain kind of value, here's some behavior that would, you know, help us maximize that mm-hmm. value or something, right? And what are the different kind of values you can put in there? Are you looking at values for me as an individual or values for maximizing number of genes, right? But at some point, we're just, you know, we're putting in values, right? And we're seeing what behavior is going to be good for values. The rationale, deciding a rationality or deciding which values are rational to have is sort of another level back, right? So there's also a way of just saying, I just value this other person, or I just value the world or the environment or something, even independent of, you know, what utility it's going to provide mm-hmm. for whatever else I've mm-hmm. got. And so I think we, you know, we look at all this and we look at all these different, we learn a lot about why we might be behaving a certain kind of way. But in the end, there's also another level of normative question about what ought we do or which values ought we be looking for. And that brings us somewhere else, I think, sometimes too.
I think your last line is where I often get worried. You know, the normative modeling is often where we run into trouble, because then at that point, I am making a decision of what is wrong or what ought to be. And then because I'm looking for what ought to be, I risk not seeing what is. And that's a challenge for us. I mean, you know, as an economist, I mean, for the last maybe 80 or so years, the focus has been on getting precision. And so you focus so much because we wanted to be like the physicist and all that. And the funny thing is, when you talk to physicists, they immediately tell you the absence of precision. Although I think it's really cool that, you know, people can sit on Earth and run math solutions and take people to space and bring them back. I mean, every time I watch Apollo 13, I mean, I'm amazed at the beauty of the human mind. But in our world, you have all these non-market, immeasurable factors. And in line with the humility component that we talked about, who am I to say that what ought to be is this? When you look at economists like von Mises and Karl Menger and the Austrian school, their focus is on saying purposeful human action in self-interest will always be right. Okay? And the beauty of that is now you are challenged to pass no judgment. And that's a tough one. Right? Let us, one of the things you say in this fellowship is that all are welcome. Now, that's a tough one in my church. You know? Because that all includes people that I don't like. But if you are truly going to respond to the call and be this living in the present and respect everybody that they are making the best decisions of the resources they have, judgment becomes irrelevant. And that becomes a very tough decision for us to live as humans. And I don't know how we deal with it except talk about it and educate ourselves and move ourselves a few inches towards the goal line of allowing the powers that have this omniscient perspective of life to actually call the judgment, because I don't know.
Any last questions or comments? Stephen again.
I just wanted to throw in one more monkey wrench that as a gay male, I'm not worried about the progeny or the genes. So there you go. I'm worried about the holistic society and become entirely altruistic, which may be why the right hates gays so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Vincent. Very much. Vincent is actually in our Department of Agricultural Economics at Kansas State, and I cannot go down and do a quick question with Vincent. I need to block out an hour every time I go down to his office, and you can understand why. Before we jump into hymn 299, our closing hymn, Corey, the final score is?
100 cans we were collecting cans. Our goal was 100 cans, and we ended up with 171 cans. We got 28 tuna cans, 18 fruit cans, 32 veggie cans, 56 soup cans, 6 baby food cans, 6 PB&J jars, 13 box goods, and 18 protein cans, and 4 other cans. Thanks for the donations.
Thank you. Thank all of you. Marilyn will play hymn number 299 again all the way through to familiarize ourselves with the tune. So stand as you are able. Go now in peace. May the spirit of love surround you everywhere you may go.